University. And this paper is from a Leverhulme-funded project on which Alison is a co-investigator about discursive representation of animals. And today she will present a paper on the song of the humpback is the most beautiful sound you can hear in the sea, the language of how people hear animals.
Close it down completely, Alison.
Oh.
You're on the front.
So you can move my screen.
Yeah,
just click on the double click on it.
Okay, thank you. I hope I can keep you all interested in this last talk of a long day of very interesting talks. And hope that will make the clicker work. Is it on? No. Okay. What you can see there in the background of the title of the talk are what we call concordance lines. So I've taken the verb here from the corpus, which I'm going to explain to you about in a moment, and made that the central node of a whole series of lines so that you can see how the word is used in context. I'll explain that a little bit more, but I'll be referring to concordance lines during the presentation. So what I'm going to try and do is explain why I think a corpus linguistic approach to this topic might be of some interest, and then look at how the word hear is used in contemporary English. And then move on to talk about the way in which animal sounds are represented in English words, and give you some examples from our data of how people talk about and write about hearing animals. And throughout that, I hope it will illustrate some of the perceptions and assumptions about people's perceptions and attitudes. And I think this perhaps will complement quite well the previous talk, which was looking at that historically, and I'm looking at it from a more contemporary perspective. So the reason for taking a linguistic approach to this topic is to do with the power of words. And this is a quotation from Michael Halliday, who's a well-known applied linguist, and points out that language is important because it is a part of reality, but it also shapes reality and becomes a metaphor for reality. And so once you've got any form of language, that language itself participates in historical, social, political processes and so on. I'm sure that's not a novel idea to people here, but I wanted to sort of locate what I've been doing in the context of that. I've also been reading a really interesting book called The Genius of Birds, and it's put much more simply there. Because we are a naming species, what we call things influences the way we think about them, so it makes the same idea in a more straightforward sort of way. So the project that was referred to just now is this Leverhulme-funded project with King's College in London. There's a team of us who've been working on it. And what we've done is collected various kinds of data. So the corpus that I'm going to refer to is a whole collection of texts about animals, all sorts of different things, but not including fiction. So I'll explain a bit more about what's gone into our corpus. But we also spoke to people who, in some way in their job, communicate with the public about animals. So broadcasters of wildlife programs. We've managed to get an interview with David Attenborough, Chris Packham. We also spoke to someone from the British Pest Control Association, the RSPCA. So different people who communicate with the public about animals in some way or another. And then we held some focus groups with a range of different sorts of people who have an interest in the topic in some way, perhaps experience of working with animals or whatever, and got their responses to texts about animals. And in both cases, the transcriptions of that spoken data have gone into the corpus as well. So this is a kind of snapshot of what's in there. So we've got the broadcast that I mentioned about animals in various ways. people who campaign on the topic, both sort of pro-hunting and pro-animal rights and so on, legislation that features animals, a corpus of news items and so on. You can see there what we've got. And I should acknowledge Nikki Charles, who's here. We were given access to the Mass Observation Project material that Nikki collected on animals and humans, and also some interviews that Nikki's done with guardians or keepers of dogs. So it's a range of things, quite a heterogeneous corpus, which presents some problems, but I won't go into those. So what does here actually mean? It's been mentioned and it's this focus of the topic, so but if you think to yourself, what does it mean to hear? Then you probably come up with something similar to the dictionary definition. This is from the Oxford English Dictionary. To possess or exercise the faculty of audition, specific organ is the ear, perceive sound, and to have cognizance of or by means of the ear or auditory sense. And this has come up a little bit in earlier papers. What's the difference between, for example, hearing and listening? And that definition raises questions, again, which we've been thinking about all day. How far is this hearing faculty shared across species? Is it the same thing when different species are said to hear things? What counts as the ear? How small, biologically similar does it have to be to count as the ear? And what counts as cognizance? We've had mention of sentience and so on today. Well, I looked at the dictionary, which is what you tend to do, but I also looked at a general corpus, so not looking at our specific corpus about animals, but just looking at a very large, it's a 12 billion word corpus of language from the internet about how here is used in English. And yes, there is the very common sense of a person, a human being usually, first person it might be, I heard a noise and reacted to it. That's a typical construction in which the word hear is used in English. But it also means to be aware of something. So when we say you may have heard the news, we don't necessarily mean you may have had that auditory experience of sound vibrations coming into your ear. You may mean you may have read it in the paper or seen it online. So we use hear in that slightly less literal sense. Apparently her God had heard her prayer. So when somebody hears your prayer, again, there may be no noise actually being produced and heard, literally speaking, but for that to take place, the verb hear is not unusual, but it doesn't mean hearing with your ear. If you say, I never heard back from them, you may mean they didn't respond to my email. Again, we use hear in a much broader sense to cover all sorts of means of communication. Where can the viewer's voice be heard? It means where can someone pay attention to something that matters to you? Where can you get attention rather than literally having your voice heard? It has this idiomatic meaning. And we have this institutional sense in English as well of courtroom hearings. So a case is heard in court and so on. So contrary to that core meaning that we've mainly been talking about and that comes to mind if you were asked to define what hear means, it means all sorts of other things as well if you look at corpus evidence. And the sorts of things that the ear perceives if you're a human being are this whole range of ways of communicating. And we have numerous synonyms for our linguistic communication, for producing sounds to for other people to respond to. So it isn't just basic idea of one type of signal travelling through the air. We describe what people hear in all sorts of ways. So I said that this raises questions about how far the hearing faculty is heard across species and what counts as the ear and so on. And the contrast between hear and listen. And here I'm going to depart, as other people have said they have done, into areas I don't really know very much about. So I also went online and looked for one of these charts and found a different version of but something similar. This range, just because I thought I need to know a little bit about this, I mean there's people with much more expertise than me, but this whole range of ability to make sense of sound or to respond to sound across different species, and this was just a few of them. and that's come up before. And I don't think I was really properly aware of the difference between this, I've forgotten the term for it now, responding to vibrations as opposed to acoustic sounds. Who was talking about that earlier on? I think he's gone now. what do you call that? That's when you're responding to the vibration in the substrate, but it's not, anyway. Where do you draw, you know, across this whole range of ways that you perceive through physical movement, if it's through your body, where do you say that this isn't hearing anymore, this is something else?
If your interpreter's hearing, I mean, the ear responds to vibrations, sound
waves
are
exactly.
vibrations of the
yes.
substrate.
Yeah.
And if you don't understand what it means to hear, then you're responding slightly different ways. Come back to Evelyn Glennie again.
But what I'm saying is, we have this conception from our usage of language of what it means to hear, and then when you stop and think about it and explore it a bit more broadly and from a less anthropocentric point of view, it becomes more complicated. That's basically the point that I'm trying to make. What about the words that people use for animal sounds? Very young children are taught that certain animals produce certain sounds and we have words for those sounds. And you may even, if it's not something that's forbidden in your family, you may even learn that this is a moo cow. You know, cows moo, lions roar, and so on, elephant's trumpet probably, you know, and this sort of, as you learn your colour terms, your number terms, your alphabet letters, you're also learning, you know, these are the animals that we know about, and this is the sounds that they make. You're also taught that this is a good example of onomatopoeia. So if you look at onomatopoeia on Wikipedia, you'll find one of the key examples is, it's the sounds that animals make. So we have a word for what a cat says, and it's copying what a cat, the noise that a cat makes, and it's meow, and so on. If you look at cross-linguistically, these are not consistent. So this idea that we found a way, to relate to the last talk, of capturing in words the sounds that animals make, you know, we can access that sort of similarity of language. It's not actually true that they're onomatopoeic, but people believe that they are, and there's this sort of stereotype view of names for the sounds that animals make. And the animals, as was pointed out in one of the other talks, the animals in these sound sets tend to be the big like us animals. We don't tend to refer to the tiny ones, or the ones that we can't see very easily or whatever. And there are very few words in the language for the sounds that we can't hear. Understandably enough, but there is that sense of exclusion of certain sorts of animals and animal sounds. And we tend to relate the sounds we do hear to what we already think, what we've already experienced, what we already know and believe. One of our subcorpora is, as I said, TV broadcasts, and the way that we've got the written version to be able to use digitally for the sort of analysis we do was to scrape the subtitles from these types of programme. And this is how they do it. So if you were unable to hear the broadcast but you wanted to watch it and understand it, it may be significant at some point in the broadcast that there are sounds of animals to be heard. And so the subtitlers put them in capital letters like this. So sheep bleat, the cub growls, goats bleat, frogs chirp and croak, and insects and birds chirp and buzz. So these words, again, are sort of fairly close set and a fairly definite and straightforward type of terminology. So I contacted the people who do the subtitling and asked them, how do you decide what word to use when you're in that situation where you need to add an animal sound that's being made to a subtitle? And they said, well, we try not to make any sort of judgment, so trying not to anthropomorphise and say it's a menacing growl if you can't necessarily know that. But again, it came down to this inherited cultural wisdom. So we know that if it's a cat, it's going to meow, if it's a dog, it's going to bark, and so on. There isn't a strict list, there isn't a set list of what you should say in each case, but this senior subtitler told me that he thought that, you know, it's not, in a way, I think he thought, why are you asking? It's obvious, you know, there's no doubt about how you would render animal sounds in a subtitle. The way in which we translate what animals are doing into terminology that's familiar to us is also evident in some of the other language that's used about animal sounds. So when people are describing bird songs, they use words like syllables. If you look in the dictionary, a syllable should form part of part of a word. A phrase is an element of spoken language and a small group of words. So again, we sort of have to reach for the familiar in order to explain the other than human, but the vocabulary itself encourages us to think about it in a particular way. Similarly, even those creatures which are not making the sounds through a vocal, use of vocal cords, still it still sort of moves towards the way you would talk about human beings making the sounds, even where that's not the case. So moving on to some of the examples from our own corpus, one of the things that struck me, and I can only show you just a very few examples of the data here, but one of the things that struck me as I was coding some of these examples of hearing in our corpus, or hear, the verb hear in various forms, was how often there is that comparison between humans and other animals. And one of the ways in which that gets raised is through the range of animal hearing. So I've sort of colour-coded this here. the sort of brownie colour is to do with the range being expressed, this contrast between the human and the non-human is in green, and the descriptive words are in blue. And down the right-hand side are the shorthands for the subcorpus that I mentioned at the beginning, which subcorpus it comes from. So one thing you can see here is that these examples sort of illustrate that the access that we have to the knowledge of other species hearing is often has to be vicarious. It has to be through technology, and we've seen some examples of that today. The comparison is typically between us and them, and when people notice that comparison, there's often that degree of admiration for the animals and what they're able to do. What do animals hear? What do they pick up on? Well, again, often there's a reference in sentences about this topic to the surprise and the contrast with what a human being would expect to be able to hear. The list of types of things that animals hear are indicated there in red. Animals are also commented on when they hear things that are important to us. So when humans are making the noise, making a sound, then animals are responding to it. And then making use of animals' hearing to encourage them to do things that we want them to do, that humans want them to do, so training them in various experiments and so on. And also recognising that animals do respond to the noises that other animals are making, and in some sense that may be an affective sort of response. So the kinds of things that get referenced are the kinds of things that were listed in the first talk that we heard. So access to food, caring for young, claiming territory, avoiding danger and distress, expressing pain and distress, and also some sense of appreciation of what is familiar. If you switch to human responses to animal sounds, then we've got evidence of this sort of empathetic response, interpreting what it would be like to be the animal that was making that kind of noise. And then coming back to the title of the talk that I gave it, this sense that hearing animal sounds in the environment actually is an enhancement of the oral landscape, that being able to hear animals and the kinds of sounds they make is something which is a positive and affective aspect of being a hearing sort of person. So if we are critical of anthropocentrism, we may think you obviously need to do something about the way we talk about these things. This is often a part of changes to theoretical understanding or to actual practice, but there are some challenges. One of the things that I think corpus analysis highlights is that there are discrepancies between our intuitions about language and the empirical evidence about how language is actually used. And this is explained, I think, partly by the fact that, as Halliday said in the quote I gave at the beginning, it's the partial autonomy of language itself. Language takes on its own emergent properties, which then influence what can be done with language. As we know, many other animals have radically different perceptive capacities from our own. We tend to privilege the visual, and I've been struck as I've been listening to the talks by how many metaphorical uses of the sense of sight have been invoked in what people are saying. You know, I see what you mean, I see what you're getting at, a whole lot of other ones, but I won't go into it because I'm running out of time. And we use our own hearing predominantly for linguistic communication. So I think there's a challenge in trying to be empathetic with other species and what their experience of hearing might be like. We may empathise with animals as we use our own experience to make sense of their behaviour, including the way they hear and listen and respond to sounds. But this may prevent us from recognising and articulating their alternative, non-human experiences. As a linguistic species, a great deal of what we hear is inherently linguistic. Could it be then that this is actually a barrier between ourselves and the rest of the hearing world? Thank you.